Hello and welcome to the MDS Podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I am Michele Matarazzo, the editor-in-chief of the podcast. I'm here today with Dr. Raul Martinez Fernandez, neurologist and clinical scientist from DHM SINAC in Madrid, Spain. Today we are recording a new episode for our Hot Topic series on the use of focused ultrasound in movement disorders. And we will focus on the focused ultrasound-mediated ablations as a therapeutic option for our patients. Hello, Raul, and thank you for joining.
Hello, and thank you for the invitation.
So let's start by explaining how an ablation, or in other words, a lesion in the brain, can have a positive effect on the symptoms of our patients. Wouldn't you expect the opposite?
Yeah, that's an important point because it's quite counterintuitive that a lesion in the brain could provide a benefit on a condition, on a disease. In fact, well, ablation has been performed for decades. It started in the 40s of the last century. At that time, it was based on empirical observations, which means that patients who had a lesion in the brain improved specific symptoms such as tremor, but not only tremor, also rigidity or bradykinesia in the case of PD. And it was performed for thousands worldwide. With the advent of deep brain stimulation, lesions were practically relegated. They were continued to be done, but deep brain stimulation prevailed for different reasons. We can discuss about this afterwards. What we know now is that a lesion, an ablation in the brain is therapeutic because it sort of reverses a network which is malfunctioning in the context of disease. Parkinson's disease is a circuitopathy, essential tremor, same. There is abnormal activity in the brain that is producing the clinical signs or symptoms. And by doing a lesion, we reverse this abnormal activity and we sort of lead the brain to a more physiological status. So in the end, this is a neuromodulative technique by disrupting abnormal activity which is underlying the disease or the symptoms of the disease.
Great. Now, can you explain in just a few words how can you do lesions with focused ultrasound? I mean, we do use ultrasound as a diagnostic tool. Now, how can you use it or play with it to make it produce lesions in the brain?
Yeah, well, focused ultrasound lesions or ablations are based on increase of temperature. These are thermoablations. It is not that one, as you well know, ultrasound energy does not increase independently temperature. But if you have, like in the case of focused ultrasound, 1,000 ultrasound beams that have a confluence on a specific region, in this case, specific brain region, the confluence of these hundreds of ultrasound beams increases the temperature on target. And this increase of temperature is what is producing the lesion. In other words, lesions are produced by the focusing of hundreds of ultrasound beams in a selected brain region. The energy of ultrasound is converted into temperature, into increase of temperature, and that is the mechanism by which ultrasound energy produces ablation.
Okay, so and you were mentioning before that lesions have been done for years or decades. What is the advantage of focused ultrasound and what are the differences compared to other techniques to produce these lesions?
I have to say that the history of ultrasound to produce lesions is not recent. In the 40s and 50s, it was tried as well, but at the time the limitation was that most of the energy was absorbed by the skull, and therefore it could not penetrate into the brain to produce a lesion. So the previous techniques, the classical techniques, were surgical techniques. And these techniques require craniectomy and required electrode penetration into the brain to produce the lesion, to produce ablation. The main advantage, and in my view, the factor that has made of focused ultrasound a game changer in the field, is that we do not need any more incision. We do not need any more penetrating into the brain to produce those ablations. And that it's a completely different approach because you avoid all complications related to the surgical act per se. And the impact, the global impact on the brain is lower than that of the previous surgical ablative techniques.
And what about gamma knife?
Gamma knife is indeed a good option. It has been used for 20 years. If I had to say which is the main limitation of gamma knife as compared to ultrasound, is that ultrasound, the effects, the clinical effects of ultrasound are immediate. So you can monitor in real time where are you impacting through the MRI and which effect is it having? So you can see whether there is a beneficial effect and if there is any side effect, and you have to correct the target. On the contrary, gamma knife, the effects are delayed. It takes a few months, 3 to 6 months, to have the permanent lesion done. So you have less control on what is happening, on where are you impacting. This is a good technique as well. As I said, it has been used. But in comparison to ultrasound, these limitations, in my opinion, make focus ultrasound a better option. I would not say that is a better treatment because each one might have suitable candidates. But in general, overall, I see ultrasound as most reliable option to be sure of the kind of impact that you are having.
Now, you were mentioning that focused ultrasound is a more commonly available option recently for doing ablations in the brain. So let's talk a little bit about the recent history of focused ultrasound for doing these lesions in the brain. And probably it's easier if we go disease by disease. And let's start with essential tremor, which, if I'm not wrong, was one of the main diseases that targeted with focused ultrasound for improving symptoms in our patients. What happened and what is the evidence that we have for using focused ultrasound ablations in essential tremor?
Yeah, essential tremor was the firstly approved indication and is the most widely applied. It was not the first application of ultrasound. In fact, there are a few studies, a case series of ultrasound thalamotomy to treat neuropathic pain, although that has not been approved so far. And in case of essential tremor, ultrasound received regulatory approval in 2016. That was based in a few trials, initially 2013, two milestones occurred that were two open level trials, in one in the New England and the other in Lancet Neurology, which show that unilateral thalamotomy was effective to treat essential tremor. And it not only essential tremor, but also the disability related to tremor and quality of life. That was followed by a randomized controlled trial in 2016, which was the one that led to the approval of the indication. And it proved with class one evidence that ultrasound as compared to a sham procedure was superior in improving tremor and disability related to tremor. And this is an important point in my view, because we do not treat tremor. What we treat is tremor-related disability, because if a patient does not have disability, it does not need to undergo a relatively invasive treatment, because in the end, ultrasound might not be as invasive as previous techniques, but it's invasive. We're doing a brain lesion, so we have to select properly patients. In 2016, as I was saying, this randomized control trial led to the approval of the indication. And since then, we have had more evidence, mainly long-term follow-up series, showing that the effect of a lesion is permanent. If you have a good effect initially, it lasts at least for 5 years, at least, because that's the follow-up that we have. That in general, lesions are safe, and there are a few collection of the pivotal studies showing that most side effects are either mild or transient. Permanent side effects can occur because we're doing the lesion, but it's quite infrequent. It's very infrequent, in fact. And there's more evidence showing that we can even consider performing bilateral treatments, bilateral lesioning. There was a reluctance in the past to perform bilateral treatments because, well, the experience from surgical techniques showed that bilateral ablation might be associated to a high rate of side effects. However, as this technique is, as I said, less invasive, the global impact is lower, then a few series has shown that ultrasound bilateral ablation in essential tremor might be feasible and might be safe, and of course might be effective to treat both sides of the body. So this is, I would say, the most relevant evidence that we have had in the last 10 years.
Perfect. And so you were discussing about thalamotomy, first unilateral thalamotomy to treat the contralateral side, and then that there is some evidence that also bilateral thalamotomy is a possibility. Is thalamotomy the only option we have for essential tremor, or are there other targets that could be targeted for essential tremor?
That's a great question, because the target discussion has lasted also decades. The universal target for essential tremor is the VIM, the thalamic VIM. However, in the past, with radiofrequency surgical ablation, it was shown that also the cerebellar thalamic tract might be a good target, that also the posterior subthalamic areas might be beneficial to treat essential tremor. And we're in a similar situation with ultrasound ablation. While the VIM continues to be the universal target, some evidence is showing that there's an impact on the cerebellothalamic tract might also be an option, and in fact might be a superior option than the VIM. There are no direct comparisons between targets, so we cannot confirm which one is superior to the other. But it's, in my opinion, it's an ongoing discussion, an ongoing debate. I have to say that in the case of essential tremor, both locations, the VIM and the CTT, cerebellothalamic tract, both are very effective.
With essential tremor, with thalamotomy essential tremor, what are the main side effects? You were mentioning that in general it's quite safe, but what should we be worried about? And what are maybe the patients that are less good candidates for this treatment because of any underlying condition that might worsen after the thalamotomy?
That's, of course, a very important point, because I said that permanent side effects are rare, but practically all patients who undergo thalamotomy for ET, they present side effects. I would say that 80% of patients have side effects. However, these side effects are generally mild and they are transient, because they are not related to the lesion itself, but to the edema, to the inflammation surrounding the lesion, which is very typical in the first weeks after treatment. Therefore, when this edema disappears, side effects usually recover and disappear as well. The most frequent side effect by large in the case of a thalamotomy or ET is gait instability. In that regard, we always tell patients to be very careful, that they are going to be unstable for a few days or weeks, and they have to be very careful of within the first few weeks after treatment. Those patients who have gait instability pre-treatment can be considered for thalamotomy if they have disabling and medically refractory essential tremor. But you have to be more careful with those. You have to be maybe more conservative when doing a lesion, doing a smaller lesion, and inform very much the patient that pre-treatment gait instability can impair afterwards. So I would not exclude a patient because of previous or baseline instability, but I would be more careful. Other less frequent side effects are speech disorders, which are usually mild, and sensory disturbances like paresthesia in the mouth or in the fingertips. These are the most frequent, although my impression and what shows the literature is that with time and experience, the rate of these side effects is decreasing as expected. We needed the learning curve. So I would not see those as a problem in general.
Perfect. Now let's move on to Parkinson's disease. Well, you, between others, have showed and have led the way towards a treatment with focal ultrasound for Parkinson's disease. Now, can you guide us through what are the options of a focal ultrasound treatment for Parkinson's disease? What are the targets? What are the possible side effects? And also, what is the expectable outcome of a patient who undergo a focal ultrasound treatment with Parkinson's disease?
Well, that's a very wide discussion. If the target discussion in ET was debatable, this one is very complicated, because we have more options in PD, and also because PD is a more complicated condition. And we have to consider that it's much more diffuse. You have the levodopa-induced complications. You have no motor manifestation. So it's not as easy, the management, the patient selection, and the post-treatment management is not as easy as with essential tremor, but essentially because the disease is more complicated. Having said that, so far with PD, most of the studies have been unilateral as well, so to treat one side of the body only. And in that regard, I would say that a good patient for the therapy would be a patient with very symmetrical condition, regardless of the target that we're approaching. Because by improving one side of the body, you are going to provide a better motor status generally. If you have a patient with marked bilateral impairment, which is not optimally controlled with medication, that patient, in my opinion, should undergo deep brain stimulation. That on one hand. On the other hand, the target discussion, well, what do we know? And we know that from previous ablative surgical interventions and also from the DBS experience, is that the STN, the subthalamic nucleus, is the most effective target for Parkinsonian manifestations, not only tremor, but also rigidity and bradykinesia. The thalamus might be the most appropriate target only for Parkinsonian tremor. It does not improve relevantly bradykinesia and very slightly rigidity. And the pallidum is a very good target for hyperkinesia or for motor fluctuations, for dystonia or dyskinesia. We also have experience with the paleothalamic tract, which is a quite promising target, but still we don't have a controlled study to show the benefits properly. The target decision would depend on specific clinical manifestations of the patient. If you have a patient with asymmetrical dyskinesia or dystonia, you know, only one side of the body, for that patient, I would target the pallidum without a doubt, because the STN is not as effective with those manifestations that the pallidum. If you have an asymmetrical patient with rigidity, bradykinesia, and tremor, then I would target the subthalamic nucleus. That is still not well defined in the field. I think, consider that we have been discussing the target for DBS for 20 years. So we're still, this is a new addition. The ultrasound is a new addition to all this armamentarium for PD. So we are still defining which are the more suitable candidates. But if I had to say something in general, I would say asymmetrical patients. And depending on the specific manifestations, you could select one target or the other.
Okay, and what about the side effects specifically for each of those targets? You discussed already about the thalamus and the VIM, which I suppose the risks and side effects would be the same or similar as the one that you were mentioning with essential tremor. But what about a subthalamic nucleus or pallidothalamic tract or the globus pallido pars interna?
That is correct. In fact, side effects are target dependent, some of them at least. As I said, with the essential tremor, the VIM is more associated to sensory disturbances and gait instability, which is not the case with the STN or the GPI. They can occur, but they are not frequent at all. The STN is related to dyskinesia associated to the subthalamic lesion. This is also a field of debate. In our experience, dyskinesia after a subthalamic lesion have a good prognosis. In fact, they resolve within weeks in most of the cases. And in fact, and that is important, they are related to a very good anti-Parkinsonian effect, because you have to consider that these are the two sides of the spectrum, Parkinsonism and dyskinesia. As far as after subthalamotomy, you can decrease levodopa, dyskinesias are never a problem. And you can decrease levodopa in those patients who are markedly asymmetrical, because the other side does not need as high doses as the initially treated side. And in the pallidum, I would not say that there are specific side effects, but there are also the general side effects regardless of the target. My main concern is impacting on the internal capsule, because if you impact on the internal capsule, you can have dysarthria, you can have a motor weakness, and that can happen with any of the targets. And that is, in my opinion, what we have to avoid the most, to be careful during the treatment to avoid any kind of weakness, motor weakness, because that could be the more disabling in the midterm. We have had, all teams and the study shows that you can have motor weakness. In general, they improve progressively as well. But if the lesion has grown and has impacted on the, not only the edema, but the lesion, has impact on the internal capsule, well, that can be sustained, that can be permanent. In general, it is, as I said, it's infrequent to have a severe or hemiplegia. That is very, very infrequent, but conceptually that could happen. So we have to be very careful of not impacting on the internal capsule. That would be, in my opinion, the most concerning adverse events.
Great. Now, you were mentioning that one of the main selection criteria is the asymmetrical features of the motor features of PD. What about bilateral treatment. Is that something feasible, or is that something that you are working on?
Well, it's similarly to essential tremor. There are concerns which come from the classical radio frequency ablation era, because it was shown that bilateral ablation for PD also was related to neurological complications, mainly to speech and gait complications. Again, as this is a new and less invasive therapy, this concept has been revisited. We were behind essential tremor. There is only one published series of bilateral ablation in the palidothalamic tract for Parkinson's disease. It seemed to be pretty well tolerated. That was an open label series. We need more evidence. And well, this evidence is underway. There are a couple of studies, one with bilateral STN lesion that will be soon published. And there's another ongoing study with bilateral palidothalamic tract, but with a larger sample than the previous one. Our experience, it is better tolerated than radiofrequency ablation. It might be, in my opinion, it might be feasible and effective in selected patients. Not all patients could undergo bilateral ablation, in my opinion. And something which is important is that at the time, ablation must be done not in a staged manner, not at the same time, not simultaneously, but with a few months apart, one side from the other. And this is because the edema after treatment, if you have edema on one side, that is well tolerated, you can have side effects, but in general is well tolerated by the brain. But the impact of the edema in both sides at the same time might be related to transient, but probably relevant adverse events. So I would not perform at the time being bilateral ablation simultaneously. We need more evidence, of course, to draw conclusions. And we're going to have more evidence in the near future. And it's something that needs to be explored. Again, my opinion, it would be feasible and useful for selected patients, not to the general population. Not even DBS is applicable to the general population of PD. But and with ultrasound would be similar. In selected patients, that would be definitely an option in the future.
Perfect. Now we have discussed about the two main diseases, which are essential tremor and Parkinson's disease. But do we have any evidence in other movement disorders that the focal ultrasound is a viable option as a treatment?
Absolutely. I mean, PD and essential tremor are the two main indications and worldwide approved. But there's evidence on other conditions. There are case series of focal dystonia. That would be I think ultrasound ablation is a very good option for focal dystonia, although we still don't have controlled trials. Neuropathic pain, it's also been explored. So far, not enough evidence to confirm whether it is effective or not. The last study from the Virginia group was a bit disappointing, although it needs to be explored further. Well, one indication which goes a bit beyond neurology is neuropsychiatric conditions. So you probably know that in the past, psychiatric conditions were treated with ablation as well. That was a completely different scenario. Now there are a few studies showing that bilateral ablation of the anterior internal capsule might be a good option for OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, also for depression. And that's a field that, in my opinion, needs to be explored further, absolutely, because psychiatric patients are complicated. Sometimes deep brain stimulation with those patients is, they cope not very well with deep brain stimulation. And in that regard, ultrasound ablation is more clean. I mean, it's more easygoing for those patients. So these are the main, I think, ongoing indications that have been studied. But in general, anything which is treated with DBS conceptually can be treated with ablation. So I think in the years to come, we are going to see more diseases approached with ultrasound ablation.
Well, thank you very much. Now, before we approach the end of the interview, can you just guide us through the whole process of a treatment? So from the patient selection to the final outcome of the treatment itself.
Sure. So the first thing is visiting the patient in your clinics. You have a patient with, ET, PD, with medical refractory manifestations. Then if the patient is a good clinical candidate, you perform a CT scan. The CT scan is to calculate the skull characteristics, because there are some patients who have skull characteristics that do not allow the ultrasound energy to penetrate into the brain. It's only 5 to 7% of patients, but this can happen. So it's performing this CT scan. If the CT scan is switchable, then in our case, that's not generalized probably, but in our case, we perform an MRI to see any structural abnormalities and neuropsychological testing just to see that the patient is cognitively well enough to tolerate the treatment itself. Anesthetist visit, it was like a presurgical visit. Although we do not consider this technique as surgical, we want to have this pre-evaluation by the anesthetist for comorbidities, etc. And also a blood test to check platelets, etc. If everything is fine, then the patient is a good clinical candidate, has no contraindication, and the patient can undergo the treatment.
And how is the treatment itself? So the patient, how long does he stay in the hospital? How long does he take the treatment?
Well, patients need to get admitted and shave their heads, because the hair can interfere with the ultrasound beam, so they need to have their head shaved. Then we placed the stereotactic frame. We placed the patient in the MRI and attached the stereotactic frame to the ultrasound transducer. In the case of essential tremor, it lasts about 2 to 3 hours. In the case of PD, as it is a bit more complex, it can take 3 to 4 hours sometimes. And after that, the effect is permanent. We keep the patient in the hospital for one night. Nothing has happened, but nothing has ever happened with our patients that night. But we prefer to have them in the hospital. And the day after, we perform an MRI to see the final lesion and have an idea on how it's going to evolve. In some centers, I know that it's made as an outpatient clinic application, which I think it is okay. But in general, they do not need more than one night in the hospital. Afterwards, the follow-up, well, it depends on the condition. Essential tremor patients, you can visit them twice or three times within the first year. And with PD, as you have to adjust medications, etc., sometimes you need a few more visits. But well, in general, the follow-up is quite straightforward.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners?
I just want to say that in my view, because there was some debate and controversy when ultrasound came out, because we already had deep brain stimulation, which is a very effective and highly proven therapy. And I want to say that for me, ultrasound is just a new tool to treat these conditions. The ultrasound and DBS are not competitive, they are complementary, and we just have to learn which patients are more suitable for one technique and which are more suitable for the other. And this is an advantage. We have a new tool and we have to learn properly how to apply it. So I would never make a competition with DBS on which one is better, because I don't think there is a better one. There is not the best one, but both are valid and are tools that we can use to improve our patients' quality of life.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Raul, for being with us today.
Thank you.
We have discussed the FAST-mediated brain ablations and their applications in movement disorders with Dr. Raul Martinez Fernandez from the HM Sinaki in Madrid, Spain. Thank you, Raul, for your insights and your contributions to the field. And thank you all for listening.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.